like to reintroduce Nigel Pixon, who will tell us about some applications of cohomology.
Okay, thank you very much. Hello again. I have a little grab bag of things here. Divided my talk into little bits. I don't know how many of these little bite-sized pieces we'll get through today, but we'll see. I wanted to give a miscellany of applications, as David was saying, and, well, they're fun. They sort of have beautiful geometric aspects to them, and so I wanted to say a little bit about each of them, but we'll see how well that works out. At the very end of this time, I will discuss something a little bit different, namely an application that might be a geometric phenomenon that's probably can be well explained from the point of view of cohomology, but I don't know how to do it. I think it's an interesting puzzle. But before we get to the end, if indeed we do get to the end, I'll discuss some things that are have various ages and are due to various people, not typically me. Okay. So let me remind you a little bit about cohomology. And let me stick here something else. I want to discuss a little bit further the definition of cohomology that we came up with. I want to discuss a little bit further how Dirac operators fit into that definition and what it is about Dirac operators, what sort of calculus facts you need about Dirac operators in order to fit them into cohomology. And really, as you'll see, what's what makes this whole theory tick from a technical perspective, as much as I'll be able to describe it to you in this lecture, is some issues concerning the behavior of t times d as t goes to zero. So I want to do a little bit of calculation just to give you a sense of what the, you know, what we do when we're not giving lectures, you know, scribbling away on bits of paper. Okay. So remember we had this concept of a cycle. For the cohomology group of space X, there are actually two cohomology groups of a space X. This is a generalized homology theory, which is periodic, just like K-theory is. There's a K0 and a K1, which we'll see K1 in a moment. So what Mathieu proposed is that there should be a Fredholm operator between Hilbert spaces. And so far, a Fredholm operator between Hilbert spaces is just the same thing as a number. It's index. There's not much else going on, at least at the level of topology. But we're going to equip these Hilbert spaces with C of X module structures, representations in the language of Sister algebra theory of the Sister algebra of continuous complex valued functions on X. And then there's this funny key condition that Atiyah picked out very presciently, which is that this thing here, now of course this is an operator from H0 to H1, that this should be compact if F is any one of these continuous functions. All right. And then there's an equivalence relation, which is due to Kasparov. This is a bounded Fredholm operator, yeah. There are various ways of relaxing boundedness, but I think this is the right definition. You may say to yourself, well, a Dirac operator isn't bounded, so I don't like it. But the point of the matter is that if you have something unbounded, it's rather easy to make it bounded and good, so to speak. But there are situations in which a bounded Fredholm with this property here exists, for which there is no unbounded counterpart. So this is better, because there are more of them than there are bounded ones. This comes up in connection with the Baum-Kahn conjecture, which we'll discuss on Thursday. Anyway, Kasparov figured out the equivalence relation, which is absolutely the simplest thing it could possibly be, which is just homotopy. And the right way of expressing that homotopy is to use the sort of apparatus of continuous fields that we were discussing last time. And that's the whole story. So what this gives you, as we discussed in lecture one, is a way of making a what I guess is called a slant product in K-theory, where you can sort of integrate out over the x and end up in the K-theory of y, and this thing is appropriately functorial and multiplicative. Spell that in the variable y. And if you're a topologist, you know that such a natural transformation is the same thing as a K-homology class. So one of these things gives one of these, and you could just define K-homology if you like to be these, or you could apply some homotopy theory to identify this with K-homology, otherwise defined using spectra and so on. Okay, so why bother with analysis? I mean, we already have a definition. This is, I've defined K-homology for you right here, so why bother with all this nonsense? So here's the basic concept, which we'll see played out in a little sheaf of examples here. That's the other type of sheaf. This, how this works. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, let me spend more than a second. Because that's a second. So let's take something in here. So this is some vector bundle, if you like, on the space x cross y. Something in here is a class of a vector bundle. Okay. But you could think of this as the class of a family of bundles, vector bundles, on X parameterized by Y. Yes? Now, if you have one of these things here, in lecture one, which you can see again, I guess, online, I also have notes in my bag to give to David to put online, from F with this funny property of pseudo-locality, which is in the blob over here, we get from this. Well, what I explained was how to take a single vector bundle on X and build a single Fredholm operator out of it. If you have a family of vector bundles on X, what you get is not a single Fredholm operator, but a family of Fredholm operators. So we get here a family of Fredholm operators in the sense of continuous fields that we were talking about, parameterized by the space Y. And according to the Atiyah, Yannick, Kasparov theorem, a family of Fredholm operators parameterized by Y is, up to homotopy, the same thing as a vector bundle or a virtual vector bundle on Y. It's an element of K-theory of Y. That's what this construction here is.
I'm confused
about that. Darn. I fixed him, and now you're...
Why is that K upper zero rather than K lower zero?
This here, these groups are Atiyah Hesselbrook regular K theory, which you can read about in Atiyah's little textbook, for example. This thing here that we're talking about is K homology. Think about differential forms. If you have a differential form, closed differential form on X times Y, and you want to get a differential form on Y out of it, what you need is some cycle over which to integrate it, to get from x times y down to y. And that's, so you need something homological to integrate a form against to get from x times y to y. So such a transformation has homological character in y and not cohomological character. Does that help? Mm-hmm. Sort of. Any other questions? No. Okay, so this is a description of this map here. All right. So I won't catch up. I won't write down this. The point about introducing analysis is this. We have some sort of operator, some sort of elliptic operator. Maybe it's a Dirac operator. And we have some sort of invariant, I, that that we want to understand, which is attached to this operator, I of D. Maybe it's the index of the operator, or maybe it's something different. Anyway, we want to calculate I of D. And the strategy for doing so is to realize I as a functional on K-homology, and then connect D to some other operator, D prime, for which you can calculate I of D prime through one of these homotopies of Kasparov. So I of D is equal to I of D prime, and we're presuming that you can calculate I of D prime. Fine, we're done. Okay, that is how things are done, and the exemplar of that is the proof of the index theorem that I gave last time. Or the proof, any proof of the index theorem, which is K-theoretic in character, is an exemplar for that. All right. Now, I just wanted to, as I said, do a little bit of analysis to focus your attention on this condition. I want to just make the point that for elliptic operators, Dirac-type operators, at any rate, this condition is intimately related to what happens to D as you multiply it by T and let T go to zero. Okay. See, it's a mysterious condition, and how would you prove something like this? Well, I don't know. Here's how you. Here's one way of attaching this. So let's go over to this bubble on the left-hand side. That property is, you could call pseudo-locality in honor of the similar property for distributions which it mimics. Let me just do a little calculation here, just to show you. This follows from the asymptotics of this thing here, and let me just write down the two key facts. First of all, for any t, these basic resolvents are compact. This is a fundamental feature of ellipticity. This, too, can be proved by letting, in a rather convenient way, by letting t go to zero. As t goes to zero, it's as if you're taking the manifold and you're blowing it up, and in the limit, after you've blown up the manifold, it just looks like Euclidean space, and d will become a constant coefficient operator, and then you can calculate for a constant coefficient operator what's going on using Fourier theory. So it's convenient to access this, actually, by considering the limit as t goes to zero, but I shan't, the asymptotics as t goes to zero, but I shan't go into that here. Let me show you something else. If I have a function on the manifold, like we have over there, and I attempt to commute it not with f, we'll get to f in a moment, but with this resolvent operator, then this thing does go to zero. It's obviously compact because it's a combination of compact operators and something else. Here's another property which it has, namely it goes to zero. As t goes to zero. And I'll show you why. It's just a one-liner. There's a little identity for calculating the additive commutator of an inverse of an element with another element in a ring, and it looks like this, as I'm sure you know. Go. So the commutator of X is just a X inverse. Commutator of F with X inverse is given in terms of the commutator of F with X according to this formula. Now, this thing here, let's call it A. This thing here, of course, is, the commutator of F with the scalar operator is zero, so I could just remove that if I like. And T is just a scalar, so I could stick that somewhere else, maybe out here. Now let's look at what's left. We have a piece A, we have a piece B, and we have a piece C, which is the same as A. Piece A is a bounded operator. The world's simplest norm estimate is that if you take a self-adjoint operator and you add I to it, then it's bounded below by 1, and so its inverse is bounded above by 1. A is bounded above by 1. B, we've commuted differentiation, first-order differentiation with multiplication by a function. By Leibniz's rule, that's just multiplication by the derivative of f, some sort of fancy spinorial derivative if we're talking about the Dirac operator. It's a bounded thing. Whatever the derivative of f is, as long as it's a smooth function, this is a bounded operator. This is a bounded operator. This is a bounded operator. This is a bounded operator uniformly in t. The whole thing is bounded uniformly in t. Then you multiply it by t, so it goes to zero. Okay, so it's really simple. I'm trying to make a point here. So this is simple and algebraic. You may say to yourself, I'm not interested in Hilbert spaces and unbounded operators. This puts us, or bounded operators even, this puts us at Borchardt's level 2 or 3 or something, the set of all operators on a Hilbert space, you know, is kind of a crappy thing. But we're not doing that. It's not that kind of analysis that's going on here. It's basically algebra. I'm a C-star algebraist, so I don't tell my friends that I said that. It's on the web. Okay, so let me just finish this off. Now let me talk about pseudo-locality, just for the heck of it, because I am, or I was, a C-star algebraist, an analyst, so I should teach you some analysis, too. We have Kasparov's Attia's operator F. So F here is the, if you like, the polar part, what's called the phase of D. Another way of putting that is that D is equal to F times its absolute value. So the polar decomposition, that's what the F that we were talking about. In 2x2 matrix language, to revert back to the ungraded situation, the Attia F sits inside a graded version of itself like that. Anyway, this operator can be expressed in terms of the functional calculus which you use to implement calculations like this. It's just H of D plus some possible compact error. And the sort of function you need to apply to H in order to get an operator like this is not a C0 function, not a function which vanishes at infinity. That would give you a compact operator, and compact operators certainly aren't Fredholm. Fredholm means invertible modulo compacts. Okay, what you need is a function like this. It goes to 1 at plus infinity and minus 1 at minus infinity, and for tidiness, you should make it odd, then you get an off-diagonal matrix. A good choice for such a function is something like this, the arctangent function. So we're attempting to commute the arctangent of an operator, whatever the heck that means, with a function. The thing about the arctangent function is that the reason I chose it among all of the millions of functions I could have chose like this is it has an easy derivative. Right, by the fundamental theorem of calculus, this is the same thing as this fellow. Aha, we have those asymptotics coming in here. What is the derivative of the arctangent function? It's 1 over 1 plus x squared. So this thing is, what are we going to get? D times 1 plus d squared inverse f dt. Thank you, I missed off a t, didn't I? I'm an analyst, but not a very accurate one. Okay. Now, what is this thing? It's something like this. In fact, I have a feeling it's exactly this because I just worked it out. Okay, you can work it out, it's algebra. The T inverse doesn't look very good. That looks like that's blowing up as T goes to zero. On the other hand, when we calculated a commutator with a resolvent, we got a T coming in the formula. Okay, that was where exactly in the same place on the board, which I just erased. And what we see, let's call this thing and give it a name, like integrand. Well, as long as you stay away from t is equal to 0, where there's a bit of a problem, certainly a continuous. It's certainly compact operator valued. And the key thing about it is that it's uniformly bounded. There's a 1 over t, but when you take the commutator, you get a t to cancel off the 1 over t, and the whole thing is uniformly bounded by that basic estimate that the resolvent operator is always norm less than or equal to 1. It's amazing how far you can get in life, to what lofty peaks you can ascend just by playing around with such silly stuff. Okay. So this does it. Because the integrand is uniformly bounded, you don't have to integrate all the way to 0 to get a good approximation to the integral. You could stop at, say, a billionth. And now you're integrating a continuous compact operator valued functions, and the integral of a bunch of a compact operator valued function is a compact operator. So you're done. Okay. I went through that just to try and give you a sense that at least for the classical operators, Dirac type operators, it all comes down to asymptotics, which is a subject familiar to many people. With the added advantage here that the types of asymptotic calculations we're doing are really, really easy. I mean, I'm not building an asymptotic expansion of the heat kernel here. I'm making much easier estimates. We're not getting detailed geometric local information about operators out of this series of calculations. But we are getting enough information to situate D inside of a K-homology group. Okay, so there's a virtue in doing what it is we're doing, and that virtue is it's rather easy, and it's rather, for that reason, rather flexible. You don't have to worry about the fine structure of what's going on in order to build K-homology classes and manipulate them. All right, so that's a...
We don't have to integrate down to zero, so...
Right, this is a... Let me just speak shop. This is an integral which is strongly continuous on the closed interval, an integrand which is strongly continuous on the closed interval from 0 to 1, but the compact operators are not strongly closed. The strong closure of the compact operators is everything, so you'd be dead if you just had strong continuity. However, you have norm continuity all the way up to but not including 0. So if you could stop this integral a little bit before 0 at epsilon, you'd certainly know, and you went from epsilon to 1, you'd know you had a compact operator. Now you just need to estimate the error, which is the integral from 0 to epsilon of a bounded function. Well, that's no more than epsilon times the sup of the function. Okay, so that says that this integral is within epsilon of a compact operator for every epsilon. And this being analysis, that's enough, right? If A is less than or equal to B plus epsilon and B is less than or equal to A plus epsilon, then A is equal to B. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, congratulations. You've made it through the analysis part of these lectures. Okay. Let's stick with the theme of Dirac operators for a little bit. You might say to yourself, as Alain Kohn and I did a while ago, since if it all comes down to asymptotics of d, t times d is as d goes, t goes to 0, why bother with the f and the Fredholm operator and the arctangent function? Anyway, why not just look at the family of operators t times d and these resolvent functions of them and just work with them? Well, in fact, you can. You can build a version of K-homology just using that information, which is even more flexible than Kasparov's K-theory. That is to say, there's a natural map from Kasparov's K-theory, K-homology, into this so-called E-theory. We'll see a little bit of E-theory in the final lecture. Okay, but not right now. Let me say a few words about a subject which goes way back to the beginning of the Baum-Kohn era, which is the geometric definition of K-homology due to Paul Baum. Another thing you might say to yourself, since Dirac operators give rise to K-homology classes, is that, forget about this Fredholm operator, continuous field of Hilbert space nonsense. I just want to build K-homology using Dirac operators and symbols and so on. I just want to use Dirac operators that way, and so you can. This is what Paul did. So let's call it K-geometric of space X. There's a definition for this in terms of so-called geometric, let's call them geometric cycles, which I'll describe. Modulo homologies between cycles, modulo some equivalence relation. There's a long story which, when you meet Paul, which you will at some point, because Paul is everywhere all the time, there's a long story about how this definition came into being and how Paul would every year go to Oxford to visit a tier with a new definition of K-homology, and a tier would say, no, it's not good, send him back across the ocean again. So this happened a few times. Finally, Paul came up with this definition, and a tier gave it, you know, the royal blessing, and so it's remained. So what is a cycle? It's a triple consisting of a manifold, which is a spin-C manifold. And if we're talking about even K-homology, it's a manifold of even dimension. There's a coefficient, which is a complex vector bundle on this manifold. In the world of ordinary homology, one has cycles. And you know, of course, you can multiply a cycle by an integer, and it's still a cycle. Well, it's pretty clear that in the world of K-theory, K-homology, if you have a cycle, you should be able to multiply it by a sort of generalized integer, which is a vector bundle, categorified integer, I guess. So these are the coefficients. These are like the integers that you see in ordinary homology. And then a map, F, which sits the cycle inside of the space X. Here's the idea. You take the Dirac operator on M. You tensor it. You let it act on sections of E. That's a new Dirac-type operator. You take that Dirac operator, and you build the K-homology class as we were discussing before, for example, in Kasparov theory. Okay, now that's an element of the K-homology of M. We have a map from M to X, so you can push forward that K-homology class from M to X. Every one of these things definitely does give a K-homology class, however you define K-homology, on X. And Atiyah showed that all elements of the K-homology of X are given this way. And again, the only issue is what is the equivalence relation. And the answer, I won't give it in detail. The answer is the following. This definition serves exactly the opposite purpose of Kasparov's definition. Kasparov's definition of the equivalence relation is designed to give you the maximal chance of showing that two things are equivalent. This definition is designed to make it as easy as possible to show that some invariant, which is defined on elliptic operators, actually depends only on the K-homology class of the operator. So this equivalence relation makes it as difficult as possible for two cycles, to be equivalent to one another. That's the, you know, if you're trying to prove the index theorem, if you think about it for a moment, that's the good thing to do. If you operate this version of K-homology in tandem with Kasparov's version. So it consists of various natural operations. One is Bordism. I won't write down what that is. You can easily imagine. Another is something called direct sum disjoint union. There's a sort of there are two ways in which you can attempt to add cycles together. One is, as in Bordism theory, you just take the disjoint union of cycles and you can decree that that's the sum. But if you have two cycles for which the manifold happens to be the same and the map happens to be the same, you might just take the direct sum of the vector bundles. Okay, so this axiom says that those two versions of direct sum are decreed to be equivalent, so that the results of those two direct sum, those two addition operations are equivalent. That's built in to the definition. And then one other thing, which again I'm not going to say anything about in detail. One thing about K-theory is that it's two-periodic, not non-periodic or not aperiodic or anything like that. K-homology is also two-periodic. As things stand, the dimension of this manifold, 2K, is invariant. I mean, it's invariant under this modification axiom, this disjoint union axiom I just described. It's also invariant under Bordism. You cannot have a manifold with four- and six-dimensional boundary components if it's connected. So you have to have something which implements butt periodicity, and here's what it is. You're allowed to replace under suitable hypotheses the manifold M by a suitable spin-C sphere bundle over it. Okay. This is like the multiplication axiom in the proof of the index theorem. Okay, so there it is.
This is mostly related to the common point.
Yeah. it's closely related. I'll come back to that. Issue of making a version of K-homology which is even more closely related to complex Bordism is a very relevant one. This is closely related to, but not equivalent to, Kornfloyd. Yeah, I mean, and what we're saying is you start off with spin-C Bordism. It's a funny issue of coefficients. You're tensoring over some push-forward map to a point, and then you have to periodize somehow, and then you get K-theory. To get these operations in the right order to see that this really is K-homology is a little tricky. For example, the thing that I've written down is not obviously a homology theory. That's really the problem. So you've got to fiddle with it a little bit to make it a homology theory, make it obviously a homology theory. Okay, so there's a map from this geometric theory. Let me just leave off the zero. So the theory of Matir and Kasparov, which is exactly what I said it was. You take the Dirac operator, you multiply it by E, you form the bounded operator F that we described before, and then you push forward from the K-homology in the sense of Kasparov and Matir of M into X. There's an issue here, which is that this is whether or not this is well-defined. But it is. Some basic calculus shows you that that is so. Yeah? It's Z2 graded. It's graded by the I've described here only K0. I could have let M be an odd dimensional manifold, and then the same definition would have given me an odd dimension, an odd group, K1 instead of K0. I should say that the sphere bundles involved here have even dimensional fibers, so the parity of the dimension of M is not altered as you modify by a sphere bundle. Because of this last part of the equivalence relation, 2K itself is not invariant under the equivalence relation, but the parity of 2K, well, that is to say the evenness, is invariant. But we can do the whole thing with odd manifolds and get an odd group as well. And you could easily imagine how to build a relative group as well. Okay, this is well-defined. This is basically, let me put it this way. And the other thing is, by virtue of the sort of basicness of the definition, this thing is obviously a natural transformation. Actually, an isomorphism, equivalence. And that allows you to consider the following diagram. This map is usually called mu. It's a version of the Baum-Conn map. We could go down to a point here. Go down to a point over here. The K-homology of a point is just Z. So this is just the collapse map to a point. And this diagram is a sort of K-homological version of the index theorem or of Riemann-Roch, Grothendieck-Riemann-Roch. It's easy to see. It's easy to calculate this map. After all, it's just defined purely in terms of manifold theory. This group is the integers, and you want to figure out what this map is at the level of what the integer is that you attach to a given geometric cycle. It's easy to see that what the integer is the topological index that we described before. Basically the Aruf genus of M times the Chern character of V. Aruf class times the Chern character integrated. So going this way, you get the topological index, and going this way, you get the analytic index, because this says to go over here, build one of these funny Fredholm things of a tier, and to go down here means forget about the C of X business, and now you just have a Fredholm operator, and you get the analytic index. So this is a nice conceptual way of thinking about the index theorem. Sort of Grothendiecky way of thinking about the index theorem as the existence of a natural transformation. Okay. Of course, it doesn't help you prove the index theorem. The proof of the index theorem is all wrapped up here. But it's a very nice way conceptually of organizing the index theorem if you're a David Bensby type of person, you probably like this a lot. I like it. It does have some useful properties. So here's a let me just mention this very briefly, an interesting application which goes beyond the index theorem to secondary invariants. Suppose I have a space X and a map from that space to the classifying space of some group pi. It might be the fundamental group, for example. And suppose I have, can't use pi again, two representations of this group pi, two finite dimensional unitary representations of this group pi. Well, each one of these representations determines a flat vector bundle on the classifying space, and those two flat vector bundles, of course, pull back to two flat vector bundles on X, and I can take a Dirac operator, such as one that might exist on this manifold M here, and twist it by those two flat vector bundles. And for each flat vector bundle, for each operator, which I've obtained after I've done the twisting, I could form the so-called Ater invariant, which is a renormalization of the number of positive eigenvalues of the operator minus the number of negative eigenvalues. And you could do that for both of these fellows, and then you could take their difference. And when you take their difference, you get a number, which is called a relative Ater invariant. What is it? Well, it's an invariant for operators such as Dirac operators on any manifold M, which is equipped with a map into X, which by means of which we can pull back these vector bundles one more stage. It really only makes sense to do this in the odd-dimensional case because of, by virtue of supersymmetry, there's an exactly the same number of positive eigenvalues of an even-dimensional Dirac operator as there are negative eigenvalues. So you always get zero for each of these Ater invariants individually in the even-dimensional case, as long as you disregard what happens at for the eigenvalue zero. But in the odd-dimensional case, it's really interesting to see what happens here. And, for example, you can distinguish Lens spaces, as everyone thought about this knows, using this invariant. Okay, so here's a beautiful fact, which is an illustration of the utility of Paul's definition. This business of taking relative Ater invariants, rho for relative, and they depend on what? They depend on whatever this map is. I'll just leave that out. They depend on sigma 1 and sigma 2. We get a map from the k-homology of B pi now into, associated to each cycle, which is a Dirac operator, we can take this relative Ater invariant and we get a real number. And this map is well defined, actually, modulo integers, as you pass, as an eigenvalue drifts from positive to negative, there's an integral difference to this relative Ater invariant, and it's hard to control for that. So this quantity here becomes well-defined at the level of homology. How do you know it becomes well-defined at the level of homology? This is pretty tough to establish from the Kasparovian point of view, but it's easy to establish from the Baumish point of view because the equivalence relation is so tight and controlled and simple, and you can just check each of these three modifications individually to see that the worst that ever happens to the relative Ater invariant as you make one of the modifications is that an integer jump occurs. So there's an application of this, which is work that I think Mattai was the first one to really think about relative Ater invariance in this context, but the theorem I'm about to mention is due to Schmuel-Weinberger, first of all using Witt spaces and intersection homology, and secondly in joint work with myself and Eric Gentner on the Novikov conjecture and Baum-Kahn, which I'll talk about next time. Which is this, that um, what's a good way of stating it. Yeah, so the relative atrium variant. This thing is a homotopy invariant. At least, as I've stated it here, modulo Q, I'd have to give you a more elaborate discussion to get rid of the Q, but you can in certain situations. It's a homotopy invariant mod Q when applied to the signature operator. So these are new and rather interesting, not new anymore, they were new and interesting homotopy invariants attached to manifolds. So we have, what's involved here is an interesting sort of switch. This operation here, this relative atrium invariant operation, is well defined by virtue of Paul's definition. On the other hand, Paul's definition of K-homology is the same as Kasparov's and Atiyah's definition of K-homology. And now we're in the world of functional analysis, and we can apply some of the technology that I'll talk about next time, some of the Baumkorn Sister algebra technology. And what you can show is that this topological K-homology group injects into a certain Sister algebra K-theory group, at least rationally. And inside that Sister algebra K-theory group, you can prove a basic homotopy invariance statement. And if you can prove it there in the image of an injective map, of course you proved it back in here. So this is a theorem which plays off the two definitions of K-homology that I've given in a nice way, the geometric one of Paul and the analytic one of Atiyah and Kasparov. Okay, so that gives you, I hope, some sense of some of the possibilities. Any questions? Okay, let me skip a topic here. Mention a couple of things. I can't resist telling you about the next thing because it's just so pretty. This is not one of the things you asked me to talk about, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway. So there. This is the title of a paper, more or less. World's Simplest Index Theorem. This is work of my former student, Eric Van Erp. He has a couple of big papers which will appear in the annals very soon. They're not called the World's Simplest Index Theorem. He's written a beautiful expository piece which boils down what he did in these very substantial papers to something extremely cute. Okay. The world's simplest index theorem really is the index theorem for Toeplitz operators on a circle. But we live in modern and sophisticated times, and now this is regarded as not just simple but trivial, so it's not really a theorem at all. What I'm going to describe is a theorem which is simple but highly non-trivial, very difficult to prove this theorem. And it's an excellent illustration of the philosophy I was trying to promote. The operator I'm going to describe is a complicated operator, but it turns out to be homotopic to a much simpler operator. I'm not going to describe why that is so. And it's that simple operator to which it's a regular elliptic pseudo-differential operator to which the Atiyah-Singer theorem can be applied to give the theorem I'm about to describe. But it's the statement I want to give you because it's just so much fun. Suppose you have a three-dimensional manifold. Suppose you have a plane bundle inside the tangent bundle. Is oriented. Well, that actually will follow from everything else that's going to come down. And suppose that the quotient, which is a line bundle, suppose this is oriented, so it's trivial. This is one special case of Eric's work, a very, very special case, but it's a fun one. Okay. Now, suppose we take all of the vector fields with values in H, and suppose we take their Lie brackets, and suppose this thing generates T modulo H. So when you take the Lie bracket of two fields, unless H is an integrable, you will not get something back in the field, and you might conceivably get, in fact, everything. And this is what's happening in this particular situation. Okay. So now choose a vector field Z which trivializes T mod H. So it's at each point it is not in H. Now you can do the following thing. At each point of the manifold, if you have two vectors at each point of the manifold, you can extend them to vector fields. Now you have two vector fields. And you can take their Lie bracket, and now you'll have a third vector field. And you can look at that Lie bracket modulo H, which is just a copy of R by virtue of this trivialization. And this thing here is non-degenerate and obviously anti-symmetric. This is given by the bracket. It's a symplectic structure on HP. It's a fact. It's kind of amazing. But each time you have... among other things, of course, H is now oriented because it's a symplectic vector space. It carries a complex structure, if you like. It's a fact that whenever you have an oriented plane bundle of any three manifold, you can move that oriented plane bundle so that this becomes non-degenerate, so that this condition here is satisfied. So these things actually occur all over the place. Good example is the three-dimensional sphere. It's a good example for this, not a good example for what I'm about to say. It's a three-dimensional sphere, and inside any tangent space of the three-dimensional sphere, we can look at the orthogonal complement of the normal, the orthogonal complement of I, square root of minus 1, times the normal vector. That's a two-dimensional plane that gives one of these so-called contact structures. Okay? What else do we need to tell you here? And as I say, this gives an orientation. For later purposes, let's choose a class. It turns out you can always choose it to be even. Choose a class which is Poincaré dual to the Euler class. One-dimensional cycle. Doesn't really matter, it just makes the normalizations. I could get rid of the two if you like. Okay, now. I want to build a certain operator, D. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to fix a Euclidean structure on H. Metric in each of the fibers of H. Okay, and then I want to build a sort of Laplacian which only differentiates in the H directions. No problem. This is just div grad, divs of H times grads of H, where grad H means you'd never differentiate in the direction orthogonal to H. So this is ddx squared plus ddy squared but without any ddz squared. It's an operator just of two directions. It's not an elliptic operator because to be elliptic means you differentiate in all directions equally. Ellipticity is a sort of isotropy condition. It says that all directions are treated equally. And here they're not. So that thing's not elliptic. Nor is this modification that I'm about to write down. We have this extra vector field Z. And let's do the following thing. Let's take I square root of minus 1 times alpha times Z. Where alpha is just some scalar function on M. So this is an operator on functions. It's the world's simplest index theorem. No fancy spinners. It's an operator on functions. Okay. Here's the kind of startling theorem if you've never seen this sort of thing before. Suppose you'd look at the image of alpha. And suppose it doesn't contain any odd integers. Then this operator here, it's a Fredholm operator. In a good way, in the same way that the Dirac operator is a good Fredholm operator, it doesn't matter if you're looking at C infinity solutions to the Dirac equation, or distributional solutions, or L2 equations, the L2 solutions, the index is always the same. The same sort of thing here. So same stability as for regular elliptic operators, for example, for the Dirac. So we could work with C infinity or L2, etc. You always get the same index. So that's a fact about the functional analysis of this operator. This is an example of an operator which is elliptic, but not in the standard calculus of the symbol calculus that we're familiar with. So what's its index? And here's the amazing answer. So Eric really nailed this subject dead in this paper and described not only the most general conceivable index theorem, but the most beautiful and conceptual way of proving it. But the particular formula I'm about to write down, I don't know if they really boiled it down as much as Eric did here, but this is basically due to Charlie Epstein and Richard Melrose. Here's what you do. I just love this. I don't know. Something about this formula makes me smile. Can you read it over here? Is it? Yeah. Well, it's a big sum over the odd integers. So there's some coefficient here. I might as well give you the actual correct theorem, which I think is just k minus 1. And what is the coefficient multiplying? Well, we'll take the winding number of what? Well, we have a particular distinguished cycle C, so we will wind around the cycle C. And what function will we use? Well, we have this function alpha. We can just restrict alpha to C, and then we'll get a function on a one-dimensional cycle. And this function avoids all odd integers, so we can wind around any odd integer. And what we'll do is actually compress things a bit by winding alpha minus k over alpha plus k. Let me write some stuff down, and then the viewers at home can read, even if they didn't hear what I was saying. So I really encourage you to look at this proof. I was trying to encourage Eric to put in some public place this little article on the world's simplest index theorem, because it's a beautiful expository piece containing many of sort of the lead up to what I'm about to say. So it uses this so-called Heisenberg tangent bundle. So this is a tangent bundle, not of vector spaces, but of Heisenberg groups. So if we're at a point P, we can take HP plus TP mod HP and build a Heisenberg group attached to this. The fact, bearing in mind that there was a symplectic form that we've built on HP. Now, when you're studying the symbol of an operator, the symbol of an operator is a function. We study operators classically by studying their symbols, and they're functions, and they're functions on the thing which is dual to the tangent space, namely the cotangent space. But now it becomes a little bit tricky here, because this is it is a non-abelian group, and its dual is a little more complicated. It's a bundle of what? Group C-star algebras. Take the C-star algebra of a vector group V. That's the same thing as the algebra of functions on the dual space V star by Fourier. So if you want to build a symbol, the symbol will be something built on this bundle of group sister algebras. So the K-theory class of the symbol of an operator will be some element in the K-theory of this slightly non-commutative bundle of sister algebras. So you really have to leave the world of classical geometry, even to deal with this thing, which, I mean, it's just a differential operator. But to deal with it properly, you have to work in the world of sister algebras. So there's a deformation adapted to this tangent bundle and associated to the embedding of M into M times N. There's another deformation as well. Which is the deformation of this funny new tangent bundle back to the original one. The Heisenberg tangent bundle is built out of a family of symplectic forms on these vector spaces H, where you can just multiply those symplectic forms by T. And when you get to T is equal to zero, the Heisenberg group becomes abelian again. So that's another deformation going from non-abelian to abelian. And in this way, any problem involving one of these H elliptic operators deforms to a problem involving a classical elliptic operator, maybe a pseudo-differential operator. So Eric proved this theorem by making a simple deformation back to the classical elliptic case. But what makes the, I mean, in order to view conceptually the deformation as simple, you have to bear in mind that it involves non-commutative C-star algebras. So it's a lovely story. At one end, there's a very simple and concrete, and you know, like I say, just, you know, I'm smiling again. It's a beautiful formula that everyone has to love. And on the other hand, behind it, there's a very beautiful story involving non-commutative geometry. All right. Enough said about that. If you're at home, sorry about the technical problems. There you are, sitting at home in your underpants, watching this. Get some pants on, for heaven's sake. God. Okay. Okay, let me now mention one final thing. No questions? Okay. Okay, so that, I just couldn't resist talking about that because I think it's so pretty and the mathematics behind it so conceptually clean. Let me go back to, let me now turn to something which I don't understand in a conceptually clean way at all, but I feel ought to be a, I feel that K-homology ought to have a role in this. So this is called the quantization commutes with reduction conjecture, phenomenon, theorem. Let's call it a theorem. It is a theorem. So I'll describe very briefly what this is. I'll describe how it ought to be connected to K-homology. I spent a lot of the time over the last several weeks trying to understand just why this is true from the point of view of deformations of operators, a Witten-type argument, as in his proof of the Morse inequalities. I don't think I have time to talk about that at all, so I'll just focus on the K-homology. Here's the geometric setup. Suppose we have a manifold, and just for simplicity, let me suppose it's a Kähler manifold. Part of the mystery here is to know exactly what the right theorem is. This is not a theorem about Kähler manifolds. It's not, you'll see the technology of symplectic geometry will enter here, but this is not a theorem about symplectic manifolds either. There are many instances of this theorem which are true in a non-symplectic world, and there are tons, and this theorem has been, or this idea has been around for 30 years, and there are tons and tons and tons of papers. Every week there's a new paper on this, and it pushes the theorem in this direction or that direction, and it's really hard to see what the theorem is really about, because it's really hard to see what all of the different formulations of variations of the theorem have in common with one another. And I don't suppose that there's any one simple, clean answer to what the theorem is really about, but I think K-homology might, you know, provide one quite satisfying environment to think about this. So I suppose you have a Kähler manifold. Let me see. Try and figure out the order of things I need to tell you. So what does that mean? It means that it has a complex structure, among other things. So there's some way of multiplying tangent vectors by the square root of minus 1. And there's some sort of Hermitian metric compatible with multiplication by square root of minus 1 on the tangent bundle. And it decomposes into a real part, which is a Riemannian metric, plus or minus an imaginary part, And this thing here is a symplectic form. That's what it means to be a Kähler manifold. It's not really a theorem about Kähler manifolds, but anyway, this is the situation we're working in right now. Okay. We're interested in omegas which satisfy a certain integrality condition, a pre-quantum condition, as it's called. It means that there's some Hermitian line bundle with some connection whose curvature is omega. Well, this is a purely imaginary form if its connection is compatible with the Hermitian structure, so the curvature is square root of minus 1 times omega. Now, that's part of the structure. There's a little bit more that we need before we can formulate the theorem. I'll go over here. Suppose a group acts on everything. A compact group. So it acts on the manifold as isometries compatible with J. It acts on the line bundle, blah, 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 blah. Suppose everything is now G equivariant. Now, if we look at the sections of L, there are two different ways of differentiating sections of L now along vector field directions corresponding to the group action. So if I have a Killing vector field X, I can differentiate a section of L using X by looking at the infinitesimal version of the group action. I could also differentiate sections of L just using the connection. And they're not, these two things are not necessarily the same. I don't know why I keep worrying about signs, but certainly not at that level of precision here. Let's do it this way. And the difference between them is a function. An order zero operator, it's just some real scalar function times the square root of minus 1. That's easy to check. They both satisfy Leibniz's rule, so their difference is a tensor. And now this, we have various things on the board. We have a condition on the curvature. We have this, blah, blah, blah. And what you get out of that is the following attractive formula, which says that omega of xy plus the function mu of x differentiated in the y direction is equal to 0. Possibly I have the signs wrong there. Or another way of putting that is that if you take the gradient of the function mu sub x and you rotate it by 90 degrees using the complex structure, what you get is the vector field, the Killing field X. So X itself certainly cannot be a gradient vector field because it has closed, I mean, typically something's going to have closed orbits. But this is the next best thing. The vector field, whichever way round you want to look at it, the vector field rotated by 90 degrees is a gradient vector field. Okay. So mu is what's called a moment map. And if you put all of these together as x varies, you can think of this as a map into the dual of the Lie algebra. Now I'm going to make an assumption which is very convenient from the perspective of differential geometry. I'll assume that 0 is a regular value of this map. In this case, because of this formula here, if you think about it for a moment, it has to be the case that G acts, at least locally, freely on the inverse image of zero. So near the inverse image of zero, the manifold, of course, is locally, it looks like this thing, whatever it is, times G star. And let's just suppose that G acts freely. So we now have a very clean and simple picture of what the manifold M looks like in a neighborhood of the inverse image of zero. And the symplectic reduction of M is by definition U inverse of zero divided by G. And at worst, according to our assumption here, this is an orbifold. Let's just assume it's a manifold so we don't have to worry about details. So this is the symplectic Marsden, Weinstein, et cetera, reduction. And here's the theorem. So this theorem was proved a bit by Gilliman and Sternberg, who invented the subject of this type of theorem back in the early 80s, and then was proved completely in this and a greater generality by Eckhard Meinrenken. And Eckhard commissioned me to think about this from the point of view of K-homology, because despite being the guy who proved the theorem, he feels that neither his proof nor any of the other proofs that are out there, and there's a new one every week, none of them are completely satisfactory. So I don't have a proof either, so it's not like I solved, I've not fulfilled the commission yet. But nonetheless, I think it's very interesting from a K-homological point of view. Here's the theorem. This thing here is a manifold. Maybe I should say before we go on. If you restrict the symplectic form to the inverse image of zero, mu inverse of zero, this form is basic for the G action, so it descends to a form on the symplectic reduction. Same thing for the line bundle. The line bundle descends. So the thing downstairs is a symplectic manifold. In fact, it's a Kalman manifold on which we have a pre-quantum line bundle. I don't think there's anything else to descend. And now you can do the following thing. Downstairs, you can take the index of Dolbeau, or if you like, the cohomology of this descended line bundle. So we'll take the Dolbeau operator on the reduced space, acting on sections of L, the reduced line bundle, and you get a number, an integer. To take the index of an operator is supposed to be like quantizing. So here we've reduced geometrically first, and then we quantize. And you could do this in the other direction, which is the following thing. You could take the quantization of the Dolbeau operator upstairs, and what you get is an index. So it's a kernel minus a co-kernel, and both the kernel and the co-kernel by the equivariance of everything are representations of G. So this thing is a virtual representation of G, and what I'm going to take here is the multiplicity to get a number, the multiplicity of the trivial representation. And this fellow. Now I have two integers, two apples, so we can ask are they equal, and the answer is yes, they are. And it's a very interesting problem to ponder to see how to prove this. You can say, well, I'm going to let the group be U1. I'm not going to tax myself, the group will be U1. And then I'm just going to apply localization formulas for the index. And I'm going to look at the index theorem, and I'm just going to read this off the index formula. That's not the way it works. The index formula says remarkably little about this. It's a very interesting thing. It's a new phenomenon, not new anymore. It's new in the sense that it's not part of our previous discussion of index theory and Dirac operators. Now, what does this have to do with K-homology? Let me end quickly with this. Suppose I have a space, X, on which a compact group G acts. Then I can easily define G-equivariant K-homology because I have a concrete and simple model for cycles of K-homology, the model of a tier, and I can define a cycle for equivariant cohomology.
The baby form of this says something like the sections are the invariant sections.
That is what Gilliman and Sternberg proved. Every section, holomorphic section of L upstairs, which is G invariant, comes from a holomorphic section. I should say the other way, that's obvious. Every holomorphic section downstairs lifts to a holomorphic section upstairs. That's what they proved. That's actually true not just in zero, degree zero, it's also true in all of the higher degrees as well. Okay. Yeah, there are many ways of thinking about this, in particular from the perspective of algebraic geometry. This is a well-developed subject connecting to geometric invariant theory. But I want to, let's look at k-homology instead of geometric invariant theory. I want to define k-homology in the sense of Vatir and Kasparov in the obvious way, namely my Hilbert spaces will now be G-Hilbert spaces, my operators will be G-equivariant, the C of X module structure will be compatible with the G-action on everything, blah, 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 blah. Okay? And I want to do the same thing geometrically. So the objects will be G-spin C manifolds equipped with G-equivariant maps to X and vector bundles, which are G-vector bundles, no problem. Nobody actually did this until very recently, but people have investigated this theory, and they did indeed verify that there's nothing wrong with it. And here's an interesting point. There's an absolutely trivial reduction map going from geometric k-homology in the sense of a tier, this one involving Fredholm operators, equivariant geometric k-homology upstairs, to the k-homology of the quotient, which is exactly compatible with what's happening here. Namely, we'll pass to the trivial representation of G in the following way. Here we have a cycle for the theory on X. And we'll just restrict to the G-fixed vectors in H0, like that. It doesn't have to be free, but it has to be compact, yeah. Just the classical set theoretic quotient, the most naive thing. You can do more, but let's just talk about the most naive thing. There's such a map. Nothing could be simpler, and what this does is it takes the Dolbo operator here to an operator here whose index is exactly the left-hand side the right-hand side of the theorem. This type of reduction is exactly compatible with what's happening over here. So the problem, which I don't know how to solve, put it up here. But which I believe does have a solution, you know, groping towards it. And here I'll end. Is to define the corresponding reduction at the level of geometric theory. Of course, once you've done it, you should show that Q, or rather mu, zero. So the Baum natural transformation, which connects geometric to analytic k-homology, attaches to a manifold, the classical thing, its Dirac operator, some sort of quantum thing. I hate to say that. That's the analog of the Q that appears in the theorem. So you can imagine a little commutative diagram in which geometrically you take a geometric cycle, in this case a G-spin C-manifold. On the one hand, you can build its Dirac operator, which is a G-equivariant Fredholm operator, or you could define some sort of reduction to get down to a cycle for ordinary K-homology. I don't know what that process is. Okay, so you could go like that, and then you can go like this, and you want to get the same thing. Say again?
Where does X mod mod change?
Oh, yeah, okay. That's the end of the lecture. Thank you very much. Now I'll answer your question. Here. So in this Kähler situation that we've been talking about, in the lead up to this problem, of course, we had a manifold. We had ourselves a line bundle. Okay, and we could, for example, take the identity, and we'd get ourselves a cycle for the K homology of M, equivariant K homology of M. And then we could do the reduction. And now, what do I want to take for F? I just want to take the map, which is the inclusion of M mod mod G into M mod G. And I get a cycle for K0 of M mod G. So the theorem, the quantization commutes with reduction theorem, would be a consequence. I mean, if it's the case that this geometric reduction sends the top data to the bottom data, which by golly it ought to be the case, otherwise you know we have the wrong, we're just barking up the wrong tree. Then of course this theorem here would be stronger, a k-homological version of Eckard's theorem.
So there's some statement that the other values of mu that this vector space direction doesn't contribute, but somehow the is something for Eckard.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Now I'm really finished.